It's Friday, September 10th at 7:30 p.m. at the Behavioral Science Auditorium at the University of Utah. It will feature a panel discussion called To Say or Not to Say. Many Mormons are wondering what their membership means to them. This panel discussion will include some of the following topics. Can we bring about change and really contribute positively if we choose to leave? Should women stay and support a system that is abusive? What are the good reasons for staying? What are the experiences and effects of excommunication, etc.? You can get a feel for it. Okay, again, that's Friday, September 10th at 7:30 p.m. The other announcement I was asked to make is that there will be a Sunday morning gathering, a protest of sorts, at Kiwanis Park in Provo this Sunday from 11 to 1. It will feature speakers, Margaret Toscano, Marty Bradley, Aaron Silva, and Ilana Kindness. Okay. And they will pass the mic. Okay. I'm just curious, how many people here have read Deborah Lake's book, Secret Ceremonies? Oh, good. Just that none of my friends have read it, I guess. Everybody I know. Actually, that's not particularly true, but I was surprised that the number of people haven't looked at it. I'm sorry, can you hear? Very hard to hear, is that better? Okay, I'll have to hold this up then. I'm sorry? Okay. Is that better? Okay. For those of you who haven't read it, Deborah Lake's best-selling book, Secret Ceremonies, A Mormon Woman's Intimate Diary of Marriage and Beyond, tells the story of Lake's coming of age in the Mormon community. Growing up in a Mormon family and going off to BYU during the early 70s in search of her eternal mate. Attractive, popular, and devout, she pursued what she perceived to be the expected cultural pattern for young women in the church and sought a man whose claim to her was a matter of divine revelation. She married in the temple, quit school, and tried to become a dutiful wife and mother. Her husband was a man whom she had never loved, whom she nonetheless believed God had chosen for her, but with whom she couldn't force herself to remain. Divorced by age 20, she had failed at marriage, the only task that mattered for a Mormon woman, and gradually believed she was being punished. Periodic interrogations by male church leaders about her sexual activities added to her growing feelings of guilt and failure. Trying to live up to what she believed to be the church's expectations of her, she married again, unhappily, and sank deeper into a depression that would land her in a hospital ward of psychotics. There, according to the book's jacket, and I've cribbed a lot of this from the book's jacket, she moved, quote, beyond the closed patriarchal society that had always sheltered her yet kept her from true maturity, end quote. Secret Ceremonies has been met with a great deal of ambivalence within the Mormon feminist community. On one hand, most applaud its stark revelations of the abuses that occur within a male-dominated authoritarian structure, particularly when that structure is part of one's religious worldview and is presented as if it were divinely derived. Lake's story provides a graphic picture of how such patriarchal structures can promote spiritual, emotional, and intellectual dependence and immaturity among women. On the other hand, many find Secret Ceremonies too superficial, sensational, and in Lavina Fielding Anderson's words, even sleazy, to foster a constructive dialogue on feminist issues within the church, and are concerned about Lake's emergence, because of her book's surprising success, as a spokeswoman for Mormon feminism on radio and television programs nationwide. As of last Sunday, Secret Ceremonies was 13th on the New York Times bestseller list, where it has appeared for the last 10 weeks, at one point as high as number 4. Because of its visibility and the issues it raises, this panel was assembled to examine the merits and limitations of Secret Ceremonies as a feminist text and to explore our ambivalence about its revelations. My name is Lori Winder Stromberg, and I am both moderator and a panelist. I have a master's degree in humanities from Brigham Young University, and I am editor of Mormon Women's Forum, the quarterly newsletter published by the Mormon Women's Forum, which is sponsoring this panel. Barbara Bishop received her PhD in English from UCLA and is the book review editor for Mormon Women's Forum. Erin Silva is an architect in San Diego who has been devouring feminist literature for the past year and serves on the board of trustees of the Mormon Alliance. Lynn Knievel Whitesides is a student at the University of Utah and president of the Mormon Women's Forum. As panelists, we will make some preliminary remarks and then open the discussion to your comments and questions. Because a small section of secret ceremonies details parts of the temple ceremony, and because of its graphic sexuality and less than flattering view of Mormon life, Lake's book has been largely dismissed by most Mormons as a mean-spirited expose by a mentally unbalanced malcontent. Lake claims it to be a personal attempt to illuminate the, quote, deeper nature of her heritage by telling her own story in detail, by struggling to cut close to the emotional bone for the truths that are hard to reach. I believe, however, the book is too sensational, self-absorbed, and particularly superficial to have successfully plumbed the depths of Lake's experience. Yet many of the issues that emerge from her story are important for us as a people to examine. While Lake insists her story is personal rather than political, it is interesting only because it is political. It attempts, according to Lake's introduction, to expose the outside world to what she believes is hidden in Mormonism despite its growing prominence. The dark, I'm quoting, the dark disturbances lying just beneath the surface of what appears to be a benign and even steadying, likable, family-oriented creed that embraces America's most wholesome and unambiguous values, unquote. After recounting several of the more sensational recent news stories involving Mormons, Hoffman's forgeries and murders, Governor Evan Meekin's political improprieties, the LeBaron slayings, etc., Lake asserts, quote, I understood that while these newsmakers weren't typical Mormons, their shocking stories weren't coincidences either. Around the roots of all the lunacies were packed typical Mormon teachings, and one teaching in particular, that all Mormon men are priesthood holders, anointed with the literal, supernatural, nearly unlimited authority to act for God on earth, and are headed into an eternal life where they will themselves become gods who rule entire worlds. It's a theological concept that, tucked into a brain that's egotistical or unbalanced, is a match to dynamite, unquote. To a certain extent, this comment reflects my attitude towards Lake's book. While her frenzied search for male validation is extreme and unique in many ways, sadly, it is not an anomaly. I commented to Erin Silva, my fellow panelist, that Lake and I appear to have been raised somewhat similarly and were probably at BYU contemporaneously. Yet while she was entering the first of her disappointing marriages, I was a budding feminist at BYU, attending meetings of the Utah Valley chapter of the Women's Political Caucus, promoting passage of the Equal Rights Amendment, and reexamining the texture and structure of my religious life and the patriarchal culture surrounding it. Your experience is the anomaly, Lori, not Lake's, said Erin. And Erin's probably right. To use Lake's words, around the roots of all her lunacies were the packed typical Mormon teachings. Her visibility aside, it is this unsettling thought that will not allow us to dismiss Lake and deserves exploration. So what, then, are some of the issues secret ceremonies raises that merit our attention? Because secret ceremonies offers a highly visible critique of patriarchy, Lake has emerged as a spokeswoman for Mormon feminism. Is Lake a good or representative spokeswoman for feminist issues within the church? Is her book a feminist text? How useful is it in fostering a constructive dialogue on feminist issues in Mormonism? What is the church's role in shaping female identity? Is the church culpable for Lake's problems? Is her experience completely atypical, or is there much in her story with which LDS women, particularly of her generation, can resonate? Is Lake's experience dated? Does the church or patriarchal culture in general own female sexuality? Can a patriarchal system in any form foster healthy women, men, relationships? Lake's book causes a great deal of discomfort among Mormon readers. Does Lake exploit private relationships, trample on sacred ground, or does she, in fact, have the courage to speak the unspeakable? What has been the official church response to secret ceremonies? And finally, what is the book's appeal? Why is it so popular? And with that, I'd like to turn the time over to Barbara Bishop.
Towards the end of Secret Ceremonies, Deborah Lake describes her experience in what she calls PI. It's a psychiatric institution. And she's just gotten a new roommate. This is an extensive quote. I had barely drowsed off that night when Eugenie sat straight up in her bed and let out a wail like a desolate animal's. What should I do now? She wanted to know. The same question I had earlier heard her pose to her mother. At first, I roused and applied myself to the problem fully as though it were a real one. What was she asking me for exactly, I wanted to know. Wasn't she feeling well, or was she just unable to sleep? This approach did not work. What should I do now? Eugenie began repeating with increasing panic. I padded down to the nurse's station to retrieve the psychiatric worker who was on night shift. When he had led Eugenie into the hallway and the shrill sound of her demands for guidance was receding, I gratefully fell asleep again and was again awakened. This time Eugenie was standing over me, chanting and shaking me by the shoulders. What should I do now? What should I do now? She wailed. I decided that I needed to be firmer with the psychiatric worker. I stalked out to his station and recommended that he try harder to help the girl. Don't let her fool you. She's in no mood for sleep, I told him. But apparently I did not get through to him. What should I do now? Eugenie was soon crying again from the bed next to mine with so much textured anguish that it fell on my ears like a query about the nature of the human condition. It was getting very late, and I really wanted to come up with something. Finally, I said, turn over in your bed and go to sleep. Sleep until morning. The room fell so suddenly silent that it was as though Eugenie had given up on everything in the middle of her worst moment and had died. She had just been looking for any sort of leader. If I had said, singe all your eyebrows off, she'd have spent the night roaming the halls in search of matches. This girl was caught in a faltering syndrome that was no way to live. And that, to only a slightly lesser degree, was my own syndrome. I realized that Eugenie was a pitiful, comical caricature of me. I, too, had always expected someone else to point out my next move. I lay beside my new mentor in the dark, feeling my chest opening and my future falling into my hands, wondering what else I was capable of. End of quote. Whoops, I'm not done, though. The question, what should I do now, as Deborah Lake discovered when she was nearly 30, is a real one, with exciting possibilities and the opportunity for growth, but only when she asked herself the question and waited for the answer from the same source. When she applied to everyone else, the answers irritated her, and she failed to form an inner identity. She became depressed and developed a sense of failure so deep that she attempted suicide on more than one occasion and required therapeutic intervention for her very survival. For consideration, then, is who or what forces caused Deborah Lake's mental instability, depressions, and despair. The book, of course, implies that the Mormon Church can be held responsible for most of Deborah Lake's troubles. I want to examine this argument. Lake begins her story with her first semester at BYU. Many, if not most, of the characters she introduces in this portion of the book are superficial and almost silly. These characters are certainly not unique to Mormonism, but the episodes nevertheless suggest some disturbing facts about young men and women in the church. Deborah Lake's first love of the returned missionary, Robert Peck, who shuns sensuality for spirituality, is a good example. The young man reminded me immediately of Charlotte Bronte's character, St. John Rivers, in Jane Eyre. Like Robert Peck, St. John Rivers is a religious man who tries to turn his passionate, angry cousin into a missionary. Jane Eyre feels shut down before his rational, ruthless religiosity, but she does not wilt like a flower, nor does she fail to consider her own internal resources. Eventually, she listens to an inner voice, what we might call personal revelation, calling her back to Rochester, a man whose passion equals Jane Eyre's. She returns to him rather than follow her cousin into a sterile religious wilderness. In Lake's book, on the other hand, one gets the feeling that although Robert Peck's imperious brand of spirituality marks some character imbalance, Deborah Lake's vapid worship of him isn't any less contemptible. She is as psychically unbalanced as he, though his priggish character probably seems more sane. I was struck by how destructive unmodified patriarchal theology and culture are for both Deborah Lake and Robert Peck. Robert Peck is all ego, and Deborah Lake lacks one entirely. In this book, Mormon patriarchy and its accompanying theology appear ridiculous, but nevertheless have dangerous effects on the individual psyche. Lake spares no one. Lake herself, however, is perhaps the silliest cast member in this courtship drama. We learn that she was so lacking in aspirations at BYU that she failed to take books to class the first week, that her sole ambition in life consisted of finding true love and getting married, that she married twice out of her intense need for a man and due to her extreme passivity, not because she loved either one of them. In fact, she confesses that she was ashamed of her first husband. These are disturbing revelations, to say the least, and yes, they did sound familiar to me. Certainly there are Mormon women who marry for reasons other than love. And I would add there are plenty of non-Mormon women who do the same. An acquaintance of mine confessed after she had been married a number of years that she married her husband at age 20 because she was, quote, afraid she would never have another opportunity. Another friend married her first husband because her father disapproved of the match. Her marriage to an abusive, controlling priesthood holder was her declaration of independence from her own tyrant father. Some Mormons, too, confuse the need with revelation. Like Deborah Lake, another friend of mine married her husband because, he told her, he had prayed and the Lord had told him to marry her. Also, she added, she was 28 and, quote, desperate with the thought that she might never marry, end quote. And I suspect that many of us know similar stories and probably quite a few of them. In all of these cases, these women did not trust themselves. They acted out of desperation rather than a certainty that their decisions were right for them. I certainly don't view my own marriage a matter of desperation, but plenty of young Mormon women and men make serious mistakes because of overzealous priesthood leaders, feel guilty when problems arise and they're made in the temple marriages, but again feel unable to rectify these errors. I believe that we have not, as a church, looked closely enough at the damaging effects which misguided and inappropriate advice by bishops and stake presidents have had on individual lives. On the issue of seeking help, Lake's experiences proved equally disquieting because so commonplace. Lake's own pattern of becoming desperately, dangerously ill before she allowed herself to leave an unpleasant situation points to a similar pattern I have seen in many, many Mormon women. In fact, in the book, Lake didn't actually seek help. As I recall, she overdosed and then let someone else take her to the hospital. An acquaintance of mine became suicidal and addicted before she sought the help of a therapist for her depression. Other Mormon women I have known seek help only when their problems show up in their children or when serious health problems result from psychological dysfunctions, which was also Deborah Lake's case. That our extreme lack of self-confidence makes us feel unworthy to seek help when a problem is merely a concern and has not expanded to fill the universe ought to alarm us. And that, I feel, is a real positive of Deborah Lake's book. I think she's pointing out something that's very significant for us. And I wondered if I was, as I was reading this book, what might we find in young women's underground cellars should we decide to look and should we be willing to look? In any case, I wish we were teaching young women that it isn't necessary to get very sick before they do something positive for themselves and in order to take charge of their own lives. Instead, what I hear from the authorities, I hear instruction in the opposite direction. For example, how many Relief Society lessons have we heard about taking care of ourselves? It seems like every time I have attended Relief Society, I hear lessons talking about taking care of everybody else. It is never mentioned that individuals have responsibility for themselves. Lake's experiences demonstrate all too clearly that our religion, as it is preached and practiced, does not always help to develop psychologically healthy people. Deborah Lake also illustrates the problems that the attempt to live just on the surface cause in other ways. The bishop, who in one sweeping declaration tells Deborah that everything will be all right if you can just support your husband more, appears all too frequently on the Mormon scene. And the notion also espoused that if you just do what's right, everything will be okay in your personal life reveals a deep ignorance about the way the unconscious wreaks havoc in the lives of unsuspecting individuals. Lake's priesthood leaders did not prove to be reliable counselors, to say the very least. And again, I suspect that we all know lots and lots of horror stories about this. The extensive probing into Lake's sex life underlines the problem with the current system of having bishops and stake presidents authorized to determine and measure another individual's spirituality and worthiness. But it is just around this issue of consulting priesthood leaders that the book finally didn't ring quite true for me. I want to look at Deborah Lake's role in her own life. Deborah Lake never did receive help from priesthood leaders. In fact, she was harassed and abused by them, and yet she sought them out again and again and again and again. But very often when she sought them out, she lied to them. And it's not a simple issue. For example, Lake states during her first marriage that she was afraid if she told her bishop the truth, he wouldn't be sympathetic. And she's probably right about that. If she had said, "I don't love my husband, I never loved my husband, I don't want to be a housewife, I want to do something," I don't know that he would have been sympathetic to those kind of honest revelations. But she never did give honesty a chance either. She never did tell really what was going on personally, and I'm not sure that she knew either. I would guess that Lake has become more self-aware. And in fact, when she's in the psychiatric institution in Washington, D.C., she says that her therapist called her on every single one of her cons and manipulations. So it seems like she's become more self-aware just because she becomes aware she was manipulating. But I found a lot of other parts of her story manipulative and not quite accurate. When she calls her old boyfriend, for example, after her second marriage, she claims that she was suddenly attracted to him because he held the priesthood. But she does not connect, in the book at least, she does not connect this impulsive return to a Mormon priesthood bearer, whom she was never particularly attracted to her girlhood fantasy. And she tells us about her girlhood fantasy on the very first page. The first sentence she says, quote, "I knew I was the sort of girl to whom romantic things always had happened and always would," end quote. Ironically, her first two spouses and accompanying marriages are anything but romantic. In the first, she is married to a man physically unattractive to her and mentally uninteresting to her. Her second spouse brings with him a baggage of psychological trauma she instinctively wants to avoid. These men are not romantic heroes, and neither is Michael, the old boyfriend. Her mental instability and want to fantasize about men collide sharply with the men she attracts and allows into her life. Does this ever occur to her? And I'm not sure. As she describes her third spouse, he is arguably the romantic hero she's been seeking. Yet he, too, fails to work out as a mate, probably because marriage can't survive on childhood fantasies and romantic ideals about men. Yet Lake never makes the connection between her numerous failed marriages and affairs with her childhood fantasies and idealistic projections of masculinity onto men. Is this because she remains unconscious? And that's a question we might want to talk about. She seems content to blame the Mormon Church for idealizing men into gods in embryo, yet her numerous experiences might have indicated to her their humanity. Deborah Lake's book exposes many of the ideological burdens that Mormonism places on individual members. It reveals the damage unthinking superficial discourses can have on the individual psyche. Her accusations of superficiality, of dishonesty, and of blind obedience demand our immediate conscious attention. But one of the paradoxes that I found about Lake's book is that we know a lot about her, a lot of intimate, embarrassing details about her, and yet after we read the book, we still, at least I had a lot of questions about her. The mocking tone in her descriptions of young love, for example, reveals a cynicism and bitterness. I wish instead Lake had been more forthcoming in revealing what she'd learned about herself from these early episodes in her life. Instead, she's content to ridicule her first husband's clothing, his body, his limitations of intellect, and content to ridicule how much he thought about himself. I might believe her when she claims, as she does at the end of the book, that she wants to, quote, eschew what is superficial among people, end quote. Certainly, I would agree with Lake's implied assertion that many church members are superficial and that the church even encourages this. Unfortunately, I did not find the non-Mormon, worldly author Deborah Lake less shallow than either her younger Mormon self or the other Mormons she describes. Mormonism doesn't necessarily cause individuals to be superficial. Rather, people who prefer to live on the surface of life seek out those more superficial elements of Mormon life. I'm certainly not convinced that Mormonism is solely responsible for Deborah Lake's flighty character as a girl, any more than I am convinced that the Mormon Church is responsible for my more serious character. In short, I felt she was hedging a little. Her family of origin, for example, gets off relatively unscathed, especially in comparison to the Mormon Church. She marries as a teen because her fiancé held the priesthood, wanted to marry her, and said God wanted to marry her. Her parents, she concludes, cannot help her out of this match. And my question at that point was, why? Why does she feel like her parents would not be interested in her happiness? She marries her second husband because she didn't think any Mormon man would have her. Certainly not all divorced Mormon women feel this way. And she later seeks out an old boyfriend because he held the priesthood while her non-religious husband did not. Mormonism takes a large portion of the blame for these personal decisions, yet most psychologists would agree that an individual's personal history, her family, her friends, her experiences of childhood, most certainly contributed to her later relationship problems, psychological difficulties, and lack of inner identity. Self-esteem, familial support, communication patterns in her family. What happened, I kept wondering, what happened to make this girl so vacuous? What role did her parents' separation when she was 10 play in her later relationships with men? I'm not convinced, and again, maybe we can talk about this, I'm not convinced that Deborah Lake knows now or that she wants to know. I found a disturbing dogma in this book which says, I was victimized by the Mormon Church and the Mormon Church alone. Yet this book also reveals, perhaps inadvertently, that Lake herself must bear the responsibility for some of her dishonest conversations with priesthood leaders. One reader confidently asserts, I've read the back of the book too, confidently asserts on the cover of the book that all people will love this book who have ever dared to think or feel for themselves. Well, I'd like to think that I've dared to think or feel for myself on occasion, yet I can't say that I unequivocally loved Secret Ceremonies. I found myself very uneasy with the notion that there are millions of Mormons now out there, since it's on the bestseller list. There are all these non-Mormons out there being introduced to Mormonism and to Mormons with the contents of Deborah Lake's personal story. Lake's book was not so much a tale of war between religious faith and personal integrity as a story about an individual who opted out of the struggle altogether and then hoped a man would invent a nice future for her, which would include both religious faith and personal integrity. I wish, and I kept wishing this, I wish this throughout the book, I wish Lake's book were better than it is, because it resonates for a lot of Mormons who have been divorced and then harassed by priesthood leaders. It accurately describes how many of us feel about wearing garments. It points to many of the shortcomings and serious problems in a patriarchal culture. It forces us to examine our values that rely on superficial assumptions. But if this book is an exposé of Mormonism's focus on the trivial, its sometimes questionable values and patriarchal abuses, it is also an exposé of Deborah Lake's stubborn refusal to direct her own life. I felt like it did not finally tell the whole story, the whole truth of Deborah Lake's experiences. Like Miss Lake, I too can feel the lie.
How many men in the audience know what this is? Good, good. Are you wearing them? These are available out at the Mormon Women's Forum table.
Is this better? These white V's are available out at the Mormon Women's Forum table. Those of you, my brothers, go out and find out what they mean and wear one. I'm not quite sure how to do this. I had written some comments out. I'll just begin. It was easy for me to confuse the Lord's voice with Robert's. First of all, let me tell you that what we need to do with this book is to read between the lines and look in the margins. And look at the book, not for what it says with the words, but what it says in those areas and what it doesn't say that's important. I mean, we could go an hour on that first sentence. Once again, it was easy for me to confuse the Lord's voice with Robert's. That is how much I admired an outstanding man. I also, at age 18, already desperately wanted to marry one, since I knew that my success in this life and the next was dependent upon it. The importance of such a marriage was the primary lesson of my Mormon girlhood, when it had been repeatedly impressed upon me that if I failed to marry a faithful Mormon man in a ceremony performed in a Mormon temple, I would be denied access to the highest level of Mormon heaven. Mormon heaven is very complicated. It is made up of three graduated kingdoms, but only the uppermost tier, the celestial kingdom, has any real status. This is where the red seats are. This is where the people go who want a seat on the front row. And, Miss Lake says, and I had never intended to miss it. But I had never dreamed that I might become acquainted with it in the company of someone like Robert Peck, either, who seemed to me to be a religious giant of a man because of the eloquence of his Sunday school lessons. I had never dreamed it because no man of spiritual distinction had ever shown a fleck of interest in me before. Lewis, what would you do with those lines? How would you analyze the words and what's happening between the words in terms of seeing someone come into your office and say that to you? They sound almost silly, I think. As Lori has pointed out, it's been called sensational and silly, and it's agonizingly embarrassing in detail, documenting this life of indoctrination as a young girl. I mean, that's a lot of what she doesn't say, but it's all there in how she acts as she prepares to go to BYU. Then she takes us through the experience of meeting this Robert Peck, this giant of a man who is going to then take her into the celestial kingdom. I think the book is important to the Mormon community. Do I believe that it is a feminist book? No, that's the silliest notion of all. It's not a feminist text. And to allow her to become a spokeswoman for Mormon feminists is even more ludicrous. Sesh had an answer to some of this in his session just a couple of hours ago, where he said, we've got to be careful with our definitions. And if there's something that men and women alike must say, is that Deborah Lake is no Mormon feminist. But how then is the book useful? I know I'm going to be in conflict with my good friend Levina when I say I don't think it was written that well. There are some funny juxtapositions of words. I know Levina would have edited out of any paper I might have written like this most of these things. But this isn't the issue, I believe. This isn't the problem. I believe this is in many ways a Mormon looking for Mr. Goodbar, where Mr. Goodbar is the man in the suit and tie who's going to take her into the Chocolate Kingdom, which is the uppermost tier. Are women like this silly? I don't think so. Are her expectations of the church silly? Were her expectations of BYU silly? Were her expectations of Robert Peck silly? I don't think so. Within a structure that tells you as a young girl that all of these things are true, and you believe it to be true, I don't believe it's silly, I believe it's tragic. One of the tragedies of the book is she never really comes to a realization of the problem. This is not a failure of the gospel of Jesus Christ. I know I had my time yesterday to say this, but I'll say it once again. I believe her story demonstrates graphically a failure of spiritual growth, of spiritual maturity. It is graphic demonstration of a person brought to not even spiritual adolescence and kept there. Is this a pattern of mental illness? Once again, people like our friend Lewis would be able to better address this, but Lori and I and Lynn the other night talked about this, that Barbara had suggested this, that there are things that she is not telling us about her past, things that have to be suspected, things that may be important about Miss Lake and her motives. There was a question of being self-aware. I don't think so. Are members of the church self-aware within the context of spiritually abusive systems, structures? I'm not quite sure how much else to go on with other than I see the book as a chronicle of tragedy for women, most assuredly. Their voices, when they show us the pain, we render silly. I believe that's unfortunate. I think this is a contribution to Mormon feminine discourse as data, certainly showing women in the church the work, the important work, that is not just for women, but for women and men to do. I have three daughters. I fear for their future. Should we, who are able, not begin to build a stronger foundation of spiritual maturity, of emotional maturity, and of different expectations? I sound sad, and I am. For that is the feeling that I am left with after reading this book. At the very end, she says something about realizing a lie. I wish that were true.
I have now read Secret Ceremonies twice, and it's not my favorite book. But from those readings, I'd like to address three issues briefly, because I want a lot of time for audience participation. They are the status of women in the church, the probability of abuse in Lake's early life, and the vital importance of feminism for Mormon women. Deborah Lake was raised in the double bind that most white middle-class women find themselves. On the one hand, it is important to be bright and educated, while at the same time knowing the main goal is marriage and children. I'm sure you all remember that cartoon of the college-age woman saying, "I want to be a nuclear physicist so I can teach nuclear physics to my children."
There is a man at the head of the house and the woman as his helpmeet, happily, in the words of Spencer Kimball and brought again to our attention in 1988 by Ezra Taft Benson, cooking meals, washing dishes, and making beds for one's precious husband and children. This is just one example of how women's desire is dictated by the men in charge. In order to stay acceptable in the acceptable boundaries in the church, women can have no desire of their own. Desire is only acceptable through the men with whom they live. In other words, men are always subjects and women are always objects. I am using Freudian theory here, and though we may refuse his definition, we are nevertheless obliged to confront the painful fact that even today femininity continues to be identified with passivity, with being the object of someone else's desire, with having no active desire of one's own. This last sentence is a quote from Bonds of Love by Jessica Benjamin, who writes about the male and female dynamics in the world at large. Our country would like to believe that things have changed, although the televised all-male tribunal questioning of Anita Hill revealed to all of us how little things have changed since 1776. The church, however, takes pride in this Freudian paradigm, but I don't think they'd ever call it Freudian. In Lake's sometimes mediocre, sometimes well-written book, it seems to me that she is attempting to reconstruct her life through fragments. And as we've all said, we obviously are not getting the whole picture. Like Annie Clark Tanner explaining to her children why she chose polygamy when she knew the hardships her mother endured because of her third wife position, Lake wants us, and I think herself, to understand why she chose her own mother's life, knowing how unhappy she is. Although I want you to understand that I don't believe that a Mormon mother and a secret ceremony are in the same league. Secret ceremony seems to be not untypical of abuse narratives. Lake is clearly the victim. However, I think that it is possible that there are past abuses she chooses not to write about. There is an attempt to make her story seamless, but there are a few jolts in the book that make me ask about what is absent. For instance, why would any doctor give an 18-year-old college student a bounteous supply of tranquilizers if she had never used them in the past? What father would give the condom advice her father gave to her first husband? And I have talked to at least 20, maybe 30 of my friends in the last few days, and not one would ever talk to their fathers about masturbation. And Lake has a conversation with her own masturbation about her own masturbation practices with her father. Something doesn't work for me here. There are too many spaces. I don't disagree with Lake's assessment of the church as a male-dominated, male-biased organization which wants to put women in a very narrow space. I'm sure you realize I don't agree with that by now. However, I think in her book, the church also stands in for problems in her home. There's something about projections, however. You know, when projections stick, which these projections stick, there's a reason to. I mean, the church really does sort of symbolize, for all of us, a dysfunctional family, I think. At least it does for me. I wonder if in some ways, the inclusion of the temple ceremony, our collective secret ceremony, does not stand in for the secrets she is not telling us. Without the inclusion of the temple ceremony, this book would be another in a growing list of abuse stories. And I believe those stories need to be told and to be held by our community. And without that holding, I don't think that we will be healed. Perhaps it was included to set it apart from those other books and to make sales, which I think we need to consider. Because if there's one thing that we know, it is how curious non-Mormons are about the temple. But many of us are interested in other religious traditions' sacred rituals. And I think if you took any ritual out of context and surrounded it with words like voodoo and ghost, it would look ridiculous. Now, the temple for me has never been my favorite place, but if for no other reason that there are thousands of people who see the temple as the most sacred place on earth, I believe it should have been handled with respect and not the way it was handled in the book. In May of this year, I'm going to go on to my third point. In May of this year, Boy K. Packer gave a talk to the All-Church Coordinating Council, which we've heard about all through this symposium. In it, he tells the council about three dangers facing the church today. A few days ago, I asked my uncle, who was visiting from Florida, what he thought those three dangers are. He has been a bishop and is still a very mainstream Mormon. His response was probably apathy, abuse, mean-spiritedness. He was surprised, as you will not be, that Packer says they are the gay and lesbian issue, the feminist movement, and the intellectuals. Now, just an aside here, it's very interesting to me that during my study of feminist theory in the last several years, I've seen that there is a multitude of feminisms. Packer puts all of us in one camp, reducing and stereotyping a vital social movement. And I think that that's very interesting because, I'll go on. I'd like to read a part of his talk to you now, and I'm sure a lot of you have read it, but I'm going to read parts of this that I think are important, and you'll see why. 38 years ago, I came from Brigham City to the office I now occupy in the administration building to see Elder Harold B. Lee, who next to President Joseph Fielding Smith was the senior member of the Quorum of the Twelve. I had just been appointed the supervisor of seminaries and institutes of religion. I knew there were serious problems in the system, and I wondered why they had not appointed someone with more experience. Elder Lee had agreed to give me counsel and some direction. He didn't say much, nothing really in detail. But what he told me says saved me time and time again. "You must decide now which way you face," he said. "Either you represent the teachers and students and champion their causes, or you represent the brethren who appointed you. You need to know now which way you face," he said. And then he added, "Some of your predecessors faced the wrong way." The next section I'm going to read is his example of the problem with the feminist movement. The next quotation is from a woman who is hurting and perhaps wonders if anyone but the feminists care about her problems. This is her letter. "I'm upset that I was always advised to go back and try harder, only to get abused more. I need some comfort. I need solace. I need hope. I need to know Heavenly Father sees all that I have endured. What hope do I have for a chance to live with Heavenly Father? If temple marriage is the key to the celestial kingdom, where am I? Outside gnashing my teeth for eternity? Help me." And this is his. The woman pleading for help needs to see the eternal nature of things and to know that her trials, however hard to bear, in the eternal scheme of things, may be compared to a very, very bad experience in the second semester of the first grade. She will find no enduring peace in the feminist movement. There she will have no hope. If she knows the plan of redemption, she can be filled with hope. Packer, telling an abused woman that she will be rewarded in heaven from his white male place of privilege and distance, is unconscionable. The definition of redemption in Webster's Universal Dictionary is to rescue, ransom, or liberate from bondage. The essential element of redemption is Christ's redeeming love. It has everything to do with the giving up of power, prestige, and glory. Packer talks about the plan of redemption, but I cannot find any trace of Christ in this talk. Packer's plan is very clean, tidy, and sterile. There is no room for the messiness of life. If your life does not stay in the tight box of conformity, then for those people like Packer who are all facing the right way, you do not exist. For me, the greatest gift of Christ was his love and care of the people who don't fit in the tight box of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. In fact, his very refusal to fit in that box himself. Christ sought after the lost coin, the wandering sheep, the Marys and Marthas, all people worth saving. Feminism is not antithetical to the plan of redemption. From a very early age, women understand how messy life is. Feminism accepts that messiness. When Packer says there is no hope in feminism, I believe it is because he has no idea what feminism is about, and I think it's because he lumps us all into one place. When he condemns feminism, he is condemning many women to the kind of life Deborah Lake writes about. Contrary to what Packer has said, I have found enormous amounts of hope in feminism. I can see a new way of relating to people, not in hierarchy, but with a kind of nearness that allows us to see each other eye to eye, to really be able to bear each other's burdens, to mourn with those who mourn, comfort those in need of comfort. Through feminism, I find new hope and possibilities for the fulfillment of the scripture in Galatians that tells us that there is neither male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. I believe that if Deborah Lake, her mother, the women, and the men around her had access to feminist theory as it directs women to her own desires, not the desires that serve others' ends, she would not have had to suffer so much abuse.
I'd like to begin with the first set of questions that I read before, and then we'll open it up to questions, comments, your stories, whatever. Afterward, I hope you won't mind my taking the liberty of doing this. Okay, again, because Secret Ceremonies offers a highly visible critique of patriarchy, Lake has emerged as a spokeswoman for Mormon feminism. Is Lake a representative spokeswoman for feminist issues within the church? Is her book a feminist text? How useful is it in fostering a constructive dialogue on feminist issues in Mormonism? Okay. Jeez, it's all taped down.
People are going to have to come up to the...
guess why don't you all say it? No, this is that's the question to you. Go ahead.
What was the question?
Is it a feminist text? Is she a representative spokeswoman for Mormon feminism? And is her book useful in fostering a constructive dialogue on feminist issues within the church?
You know, I don't think it's a feminist text at all, except for in the way that Lynn Matthews Anderson read the Book of Mormon, and that's ironically because of it shows us all the problems. So no, I don't see it as a feminist text, and I don't especially see Deborah Lake as the spokesperson for Mormon feminism, mainly because she's not a Mormon, and I don't think she calls herself a feminist.
I don't see it as a feminist text, but as Aaron was saying, I think it does point out that the way many Mormon women conduct their lives and the tragedy that results from that. So in that sense, that in making us aware of what Mormonism does to a certain extent to Mormon women, I was quizzing my sisters about Deborah Lake's experience, and my sister said over and over, she said, I was that way. Just I looked to my husband for years and years and years for direction. And I would ask someone else, and I was that way. So I heard a lot more nods about, yes, Deborah Lake's experience is more similar to my own experience than different. And I think in that sense, in making us aware that there are still, the experience, for example, that I tell you about a friend of mine who married this man because her father didn't want her to marry. She divorced, and she got this rather scathing letter from President Kimball at the time, saying, don't do that again. Basically, don't get divorced again. And she has since remarried, and she's very, very devoted to the church, and she is still having experiences similar to Deborah Lake's. So in the sense that this book tells us what many, many Mormon women experience and how they experience the church structure, I think you could call it a consciousness-raising book, for lack of a better word.
Yeah. Those of you who are willing, how many here feel like her book describes somewhat your experience? Your early experience. Well, that brings us to the question then, is it dated? Come up to the mic if you have a question. Sure, go ahead.
In my ward alone in San Diego, a young woman was just married the day after she graduated high school. Another gal in our ward was married a year after, 1 year at BYU, and which that ended in divorce, and the other one ended in pregnancy 6 months later, and it's just not going very well. So to whatever experience it might have been in the past, we still have young women. If perhaps my ward in San Diego is not representative, but that, in one ward alone, is alarming.
I hope this is a place for honesty, because that's how I'm feeling right now, that I have to be. This is the first Sunstone Symposium that I've come to, and I started Wednesday evening. I came because I wanted to find people who felt as I did, as obviously most have come. In particular, I was hoping to make contact with women who experienced things as I did, women but you know why we're here, okay? I don't have to say that. Unfortunately, maybe I shouldn't have come in here today, because yes, I have read this book, and yes, it did affect me, and yes, I realized it was not going to be a feminist text. I would like to thank Aaron, because from the panel, he's the only one that I have really felt any compassion, and I think that's really too bad. What I am beginning to feel after having been here since Wednesday night is that maybe Sunstone and Mormon Women's Forum and whoever else is really, it was expressed very well. I think it was Lori who said, we can't dismiss Lake. We have to look at her book. Well, no, you can't dismiss Lake. I mean, that's what the general authorities are trying to do to us because of the way we feel. We have got to consider her as one of us. I don't believe that there will be enough people who have master's degrees and PhDs and have a really intellectual outlook on life to accomplish all that this group supposedly wants to accomplish. I don't have a degree because I spent 27 years in a very abusive marriage with a man who was a good priesthood holder, and because I did all these things that Deborah Lake talks about. You do not realize, unless you've been through it, how your senses become numbed and how you start thinking that everything is your fault. I mean, it's just kind of ludicrous to stand up here and say, well, why didn't she do this and why didn't she do that? If you really want to know, you know, why were there not any women on this panel who have been through this? I think that... I don't think I can talk anymore. Thank you.
I was quoted as saying that the book was sleazy. That wasn't quite what I said. I did use the word, but I was talking about her experiences. I think she had experienced sleaze in her life. But I think that if we look at the text, we see a construction of two voices. One is the silly girl that she was. The other one is the sophisticated voice who is dealing with that silly girl that she was. I think it's really clear that both of them are constructions because there is so much pain in both of them. I responded emotionally to the book in a very strong way. I didn't like it. I think that the temple stuff was a total red herring. But I responded to a third voice, the one that's in the margins and between the lines. And maybe someday that we'll meet that voice. I'm sorry that nobody on the panel talked about what I felt was the most moving point of the book. And that was when she was dancing with the patient in the psychiatric institution. Now, it seemed to me that that was a moment that represented healing and wholeness for her, that for once she was with a man and her only motive was to give to him instead of take something from him because he had literally nothing to give her. And that was a moment of humanness. I think that it's possible to read, to see that the book was carefully shaped to bring us to that moment, and many other things were left out. I agree that all of that is possible, but I think that we need to keep asking questions of this text. And Lynn, I really think it's a cheap shot to say she's not a Mormon. You know why she's not a Mormon.
No,
Well, she's not a Mormon because she is not excommunicated, and she was quoted as saying that she knew it was coming, and she didn't expect anything different, and it was still just like being hit in the stomach.
I haven't heard that.
Well, you know, for some of us who may be facing that soon, maybe we see it from a slightly different angle. But I think that we need to ask all of the questions that this panel has said, but I think we need to ask some more questions too.
I want to have Barbara respond. I feel bad about that woman. The fact that she left makes me feel bad because I'm sorry that some of the compassion that I think we all felt in the book didn't come through. In fact, I thought Lynn's comments particularly dealt with that. It is a painful book to read. And in an earlier version of my paper, I talk about the fact that we can't just, you know, that we, you know, it is a painful experience, and I think maybe we didn't acknowledge that enough in some of our remarks and trying to, you know, get them short enough so that we could leave time for you. But, I mean, women's pain is one reason why I'm such an activist in the church. I think it is painful for women. It's painful to be silenced. I know that pain. I know how it feels to be marginalized.
I don't know exactly how to respond when someone says, no one has been abused like I have. To get up and say, oh, yes, I have. But many of us have been abused in the church, and she, the woman who responded, is certainly not alone. I guess my problem in Deborah Lake's book is I didn't feel like she always got to the compassion level. If she had been able to talk about her family in an honest and open way, I had a real problem, for example, with all of the kind of what I would call cheap shots she took at her first husband. And maybe it's because I have short brothers that I adore. I don't know exactly what it is, but I had a real tough time with all the things that she considered funny. And I think Levine is right in talking about those two voices, because the last chapters in the book are very moving, I thought. When she does dance with this boy in the psychiatric institution, but it doesn't jive with all of the other stuff. So, perhaps I didn't respond in a compassionate way to Deborah Lake's book, but I don't precludes necessarily responding to other women's pain in the church.
Go ahead. Well, I read the book. I saw that it was listed on the top 10, and I thought, gee, it was listed on the top 10 books, and so I thought, well, I ought to read it then. So I went and got it, and I was going on a cruise, so I thought I would take it and read it on the airplane. But I couldn't put it down. I brought it home and tried not to open it. And, of course, it was short, and I read it and took it with me on the cruise for my mother to read. But anyway, it's easy reading. It isn't a scholarly book, but it's an important book. I wrote at the end, I said, this is an important book. It was her story, and that was her reality, and that's how she saw the situation. And if that's the way she saw it, that's the way it is. Many years ago when I was going to school, one of my professors told us about a book that we should read. It was called Childhood Revisited. Famous people had written about their childhood. And she says, now remember, this is their, their reality. This is their interpretation of their childhood. It may not be their interpretation that their parents would give it or their psychiatrist or someone else, but, this is what's important to them. These are the things that they've chosen to write about their childhood. And so I think we have to look at it that way. And, if it's uncomfortable for you to read it, maybe that's good. Her story wasn't my story, but I've known people who are like that. I know people today that are like that. And maybe those of us that here aren't like that, maybe we were just different from the start. I don't know. And another question that was posed, why is this going to be a successful book? Well, they were kind of flippant, and they said, well, because of the sexuality or the temple. I don't think so. I think the reason why the book is a successful book is because she survived. She had a transformation, and there's not that many, stories about people who actually change in their life, who really have transformations, who really change from the way that they were. To leave your religion, is truly a transformation. I did this study for my PhD. It was called Paradigm Shifts in Ethnic Religious Adults. And so I really studied a lot about the change process, and I know how difficult it is and how people really resist change and they don't really make paradigm shifts. You can get a divorce, but that doesn't mean you've really shifted, that you've really made changes in your life. So anyway, that's why I think that it's important, and I think she's a survivor. And, I don't think that it's a scholarly book, as I said, but I think it certainly has an important message, and she says some things that we ought to talk about.
There were many things about the book that rang true to me. I was reminded in one spot of, as a newlywed and going through the usual adjustment period with my husband, having my bishop counsel me that if I wasn't getting my way about something, I should withhold sex from my husband. Now, I should back up and say that my patriarchal blessing specifically counseled me that I should obey my bishop in all matters and so forth. Fortunately, I knew better. And at least at that point, I had resolved that I had very dutifully, as a teenager, tried to obey my bishop's counsel in all matters, but I knew enough about life and the universe by that point to recognize bad counsel. And my husband's grateful that I... but I think it's important to know that even somebody who is a lovely person and very well-intentioned can give out terrible advice, and because they're in positions of authority, they stick for a lot of people. I have no idea how many women in my ward receive similar advice, but I can tell you if they did, there are a number of them who probably tried to follow that counsel. That's a very scary thought. The other thought that kind of came to my mind as I was listening is that, you know, we should all be aware that Fascinating Womanhood is still a bestseller in church bookstores everywhere, and that people really and truly still believe in some of the things that, you know, I devoured it when I was 14 years old, and, you know, well, Fascinating Girl has had to catch them, and Fascinating Womanhood has had to keep them, and... these are significant books to many young LDS girls and how destructive they are. You know, when I read Deborah Lake's book, I thought, here is her. Obviously, she had had a lot of that in her life. You know, I stand before you dressed in the nines for me, and because I met an authority figure in the church today and had an experience where, once again, obedience seemed to be the crux of the matter rather than persuasion, gentleness, reason, and so forth. And as I turn this experience over in my mind and debate, well, what is it that I am going to do, Deborah Lake's book takes on a certain significance for me. I'm not like her, for which I'm grateful. That's kind of snobby, but I can think, what an airhead! I mean, you know, that was kind of my visceral reaction. But I could have been her. You know, I don't know how I didn't end up like her. I appreciate that she tried to write her story, even though I don't appreciate all of the elements of that story that I think maybe she was encouraged by materialistic editors to include or so forth. We need to do something about what's going on in our community, and we've sure heard a lot about it today and yesterday, and we'll hear more about it tomorrow. Or we're going to have a whole crop of Deborah Lakes who won't necessarily have books published, but whose lives will be as damaged and as fearful and as sad as what we've heard about today. Thanks.
See if this will go high enough here. I've had a lot of really extraordinary things happen in my life in the last 3 months, one of which is the symposium and one of which was Deborah Lake's book. I was a BYU student back in the mid-70s, and I guess I had a crisis of faith and kind of pulled a Michelle Warner, and they threatened to throw me out of school. This was a very eye-opening experience for me at the time, and it was a very traumatic one. For those of you that saw the BYU session in the previous session, I really identify with the editor of the Student Review. It was not an easy thing to have happen. I graduated shortly after that and left the church for all intents and purposes, moved to North Dakota, started listening to Garrison Keillor, and that became my substitute religion, the news from Lake Wobegon. For those of you that don't know what I'm talking about, ask somebody. I moved back to Utah a couple of years ago, and again, really didn't pay much attention to the church, except for the fact that it's kind of an overwhelming influence in Utah. But then in April, I saw this B.H. Roberts lecture being advertised, and I went, and Levina Anderson and Paul Toscano were speaking, and the thing that impressed me the most about it was the length and the warmth of the applause after their speeches. You know, these are academic talks by and large, and I've been to a lot of academic things. I was a professor for 13 years, and you get a few seconds of polite applause, and then they sit down. I was very touched by both the messages and the reactions of the people there. Shortly after that, let's see, there was a whole bunch of things that happened, and I should have made notes. I did get my little white ribbon that I didn't wear today because I left it on a shirt and put it through the laundry, and it ripped a little hole in it, and I tossed it on the dryer, and it's still there. I'd heard some women talking about Mother in Heaven at the Salt Lake Roasting Company when I first moved here. I was testing the limits of iniquity that I would go to in a coffee shop, I guess was comfortable enough. And the story was too good to pass up, so I wrote it down, and I figured, what am I going to do with this story? And I saw a thing in the paper a few weeks ago about a woman named Margaret Toscano who had spoken at BYU, and I never would have heard of her if it weren't for Raleigh and Wells. So I tossed the thing in the mail just a few days ago and sent it off to her. And then one other thing happened way back when. I really had no contact with the church until 1980, and I read Sonia Johnson's book. That was an electrifying experience. This book was not electrifying. Mrs. Toscano's talk this morning was an electrifying experience. So I guess for rating things of how important they are in my life or how feminist or whatever, that's where I put the scale. But I wasn't going to read the book. I thought talking about the temple was a little tacky, even though I'm kind of out of the organization. But some friends said I really ought to, and I picked it up and gotten about page 3 and realized that I had dated this woman at BYU. I didn't make the book, and I'm not sure whether that's good or bad. So, like I said, it's been really interesting. For being out of the church for 18 years, a lot of really interesting things have happened all of a sudden. In my experience, she was quite typical for a BYU co-ed. A lot of people thought that way, from what I could tell. She was bright and funny and kind of outspoken. The book seems to give an impression that she really didn't know what she was going to do with her life other than be a wife, and that was certainly not my impression. I was only a single date. She wasn't interested, but I was apparently impressed because I remembered it for all these years. And I don't know. Like I said, it was just an amazing experience to realize that I knew this person. I read the book in one sitting. I don't know if I would have done that if it weren't somebody that I remembered. She was outspoken. She was rather sharp-tongued then. I was in the honors program. We were walking up to the library one time, and I was going upstairs to the honors reading room, and she was going downstairs. And I asked, why didn't she come up there? And she said, well, honors program people are a bunch of stuffed shirts anyway. So when I saw things like that in the book, I said, gee, she hasn't changed much in the last 25 years. Yeah, we do have a lot of other people need to speak. But, well, are there any quick questions about what Deborah Lake was like at 19? I was surprised I dated her. It was a real small window of opportunity, apparently. Thank you.
For reasons of my own, I've done my own personal poll on this book, and it's been fascinating. Some people wouldn't, read past the first couple of chapters, and I grant that I probably am biased in my selection of people I asked about it. But without exception, and this is what amazed me, a lot of people said exactly what the panel has said. It's not very well written. She whines a lot. She this and that and the other. But every single person I asked said, I'm glad she wrote the book. And that really amazed me, because some of these people were really, the women at least, were mainstream people. And so when I pressed them further, they said because it touched issues. They didn't like the way it was done, but they responded to the issues she raised, including the temple. They said, no, it was not tasteful the way it was done, but I sure got thrown in there, and I had a terrible time, and I couldn't speak of it for years, and at least it's been said. Also, the repressed sexuality that came out so blatantly, and again, not tastefully, but, this is an area that who is writing about Mormon women's sexuality except in textbook form? A woman in New York I spoke to about it is a very sophisticated fine writer by anyone's criteria, I believe. It's an extremely fine writer. She said, I knew this wasn't a good book but I cried through a lot of it. It touched my issues so deeply. So I think that it's been a very wise thing to have this panel. I think that what it says to me is we need to talk and we need to be writing about things that really matter in the most personal sense.
I bought and read the book for the same reason that I buy things that cross the political spectrum, and I buy the church news, and I subscribe to just about everything to find out what people are thinking. I was at BYU a lot before most of the rest of you had an opportunity to be, but I saw that kind of essential silliness, very naive kind of girl. And I couldn't help wondering, as I read the book and as I've been here today, about the essential silliness that we impose on our daughters. To the extent, I was raised without a father, he having died when I was an infant. And I was raised by a strong mother, so I was not directly under the patriarchal system, although, of course, it was all around me. Grandfather, sick patriarch, and all that kind of thing. But despite that, and I was planning on a career, so when I went to BYU, I was definitely not there to get a mate. I was there to further my musical education and so on. But I saw a lot of people who, like her, apparently were there just to do that, and I wondered what it would be like and what we're doing to our daughters, and I hope we're not doing that as much now, that making marriage the very end. I mean, as if women had no identity of their own. As a matter of fact, I can remember it, although I don't remember it taking, that you really gained your identity by the man you married. Now, that was a long time ago, and most of you who are younger probably got over that notion. But I know when I married, I interrupted a somewhat budding career to marry. Then all of a sudden I started thinking about what the Mormon expectation was, and I thought, well, you know, I'm no longer a singer, I'm no longer this or that or the other, so I'll find out what it's like to try to absorb myself in my husband's identity. Well, fortunately, and I'm not sure my husband of 48 years would agree with this, I was as strong-minded as he, and we had a few discussions about why there needed to be a boss, why somebody had to be in charge, and so on. It's been an ongoing thing. But my point is, no blow struck with intent to kill. But despite that, I know a little bit about, and I've seen other people who've been caught in this trap. I've seen extreme victimization and women who simply had no tools with which to deal with it. I think the Deborah Lakes still exist. You watch them and you see their pain. So from that point of view, I think those of us who have found ourselves strong enough to withstand it, or who have gone through pain and still have pain, we still should be aware that there are some people who simply, by virtue of their training, and unfortunately some of that training is given by us, they have no tools with which to assert their own identity. I didn't like the book. I felt she was an extremely silly girl. And I couldn't imagine anyone being quite that naive, and yet I've seen her counterpart. I know she exists. I know she existed when I was a young girl. I look at some of the upcoming children, and I'm afraid she's still going to exist unless we do more of the things we're trying to do to help women find their own identities. Then they can form a good relationship with a man whose identity is based not on domination, but by the two of them together working out something for the greater good of both. Thank you.
Well, I hope not to offend anyone, but I'm probably sure I will. But as I tell my students that I teach in school, if I don't offend you, you're not learning anything, I guess. But make it short. Yeah, well, okay, well, this will be short. But I rather think probably the book has made its stature probably because of the temple things and the sexual content, because I think to sell that many books, there's still only 5 million, about 5 million Mormons. I don't know how many in the United States, so we're still a small, minute portion of the population. So to get that many people to read it, I think there's sensational elements of the book, obviously. But please remember out there that no matter who says it, Boyd K. Packer, your bishop, your stake president, that we're all free agents, and no matter how they come to try to take that away from us, that we are. And if we should embrace that one concept and fight hard from anyone who will come and take that away from us. And this was a... They did excellent.
I don't have a comment as such, but I would like to make two very brief observations. We have been discussing the book. Sounded like a book discussion group. We needed to have talked about a life that hurt, life was in pain, and a person who had been marginalized. Sunstone, I think, is about people who are got marginalized by an institution. And sometime when we get together and marginalize those that are hurting, I think we needed to perhaps approach this a little differently. It was more or less an observation. It was not a criticism of anything, that people's lives can very easily be talked about as books. Broken sentences, but hurts are full. So I think... I have read the text that Laurie gave me an hour ago. I read 51 pages into it to feel the hurt, to feel the pain. That's where we need to connect. Thank you.
One thing I have always abhorred is stupidity. And my initial reaction to Deborah Lake when I read her book was, this is one pretty stupid woman. I mean, I had a Mormon upbringing, and I went to BYU, and I admit I went there thinking I would find Mr. Right. But no way would I have ever married a man I didn't love, even if God had told me to do it. I sympathized with her in her first marriage because my husband treated me somewhat that way too, as an object, as a possession. And that's how I saw her first husband treating her. She blames that on the church, on her husband's priesthood. I don't have that excuse with my ex-husband because he was not LDS. He did not have the priesthood. It was just he was that way. He felt that a woman was a possession. So it's not the fact that a man holds the priesthood that causes him to subjugate a woman. It's just the fact that he's a man. And so we can't blame the church for, and Deborah can't blame the church for her problems. She was just a very naive and stupid woman, and she paid for her mistakes. And we have to all accept responsibility for our mistakes, and we can't blame the church because we do, as the gentleman before said, have our free agency. I am a divorced woman. I have never been abused by my priesthood authorities. When I did make the decision to leave my husband, I went to my bishop, who at that time was also my department chairman at BYU Hawaii, and my friend, and told him that I had fasted and prayed about my decision and felt it was the right one. At that time, he said, no, the Lord would never tell you that a divorce was the right answer. But later, after my divorce, when he saw the difference in me, he apologized to me for having said that and realized that the divorce was the best thing I could have done. So I have never felt the abuse of priesthood authorities because of my decision to be a divorcee. But I know that these abuses do occur. But I just think that we have to realize that people are only people, And I think the abuse is not consistent, that there are bishops and stake presidents who are loving and who give good counsel. And if we happen to get a bad one, I think we just have to go to somebody else, go above them or something like that. But we can't blame the church for the people in it.
I sort of have to respond to that. I think that's really very harsh. And I think what I was trying to say in my paper, and maybe didn't get across because I had it, such a short paper, is that it's a setup, I think, for women to have the kind of life that Deborah Lake has. And perhaps your life was different, and perhaps my life was different, but I just have seen too much how the paradigm of the woman being the object sets it up so that these kinds of lives happen, these kinds of abuses happen. And to say that you can go over a bishop's head, it's been my experience that that's just not possible for women. And I don't know, and I think for many men it's not possible to do that, that you are stuck in the little tiny box that you're given, and to step out puts you in the margins. So that's all I have to say.
I listened to Deborah Lake on a couple of talk shows on the radio and on TV. I listened to Deborah Lake on a couple of talk shows on the radio and TV, and I was really taken aback by how refreshingly open she was about her superficialities or whatever. She was so disarming, and I was so charmed, maybe that's the wrong word to use, but, you know, I was really moved by it. And it's funny, when I read the book, I thought, well, mainstream Mormons will be able to discount it because of the 3 divorces and 2 institutionalizations, so they won't even give it any credence at all. And I thought Mormon women feminists will find it just too silly or whatever, you know, and I feel that way partly. And yet a lot of it rang true as far as being at BYU, feeling all that stuff. I mean, I have a lot more masculine influences in my own character, but as far as being a very feminine woman, you know, I don't know, a lot of it was just so honest and so, I don't think you could dismiss it all. I'm sorry that she revealed a lot of stuff that's painful for a lot of people, but I hope people don't dismiss it out of hand, because listening to her speak, like I say, when people would call into the talk shows and speak to her, she wouldn't get into any of these fights or anything. She just simply would state, she'd say things like, well, it was my experience this way, and she wasn't church bashing particularly or anything. And it's like she was admitting that her ego wasn't formed fully or healthily. And I honestly didn't feel like she was necessarily blaming the church entirely. Not that she was blaming herself, but it was like a fact that this is how, in an institution that will not allow you to grow up and to make decisions for yourself, that you're not going to be able to develop entirely in healthy ways. So.
This is kind of odd that people are just coming up and asking or making comments rather than asking questions, but I'm going to respond similar to how Lynn just responded. And for those of you who were just in the last session where BYU students were speaking out, this is going to be similar, hopefully a little more articulate. But I sat and listened to some people who had left BYU or people who had never attended BYU suggest that it's the student body's problem of what's happening at BYU. And to suggest that Deborah Lake could have just gone out of this situation anyway, and I have not read the book, but I've talked to people who have, I've listened to the panel, and I've heard her as well. But I think we need to stop blaming the victim, and we need to start recognizing where the abuse is coming from. And that's all. So thanks.
I want to respond just briefly to that. I agree that we need to stop blaming victims. I have been a victim for a number of years. And in order to stop being a victim, I had to do something about it. So, yes, we need to stop blaming victims. But if I just bitch about all the perpetrators who abused me, if I bitch about the Mormon Church, which I have done,
if I stay in that particular mode my whole life, I will not stop being a victim. So I really did sympathize with the woman who spoke first and said that we were not being compassionate. I think that life is a process, and at certain points we do need to get angry. We need to do all of those things. But at some point, when you are a victim, you have to choose yourself personally to stop being one.
We really do have to close. There are just a couple of parting comments I would like to make. And that's in regard to the churches, the official church's response to secret ceremonies. Deborah Lake has appeared on several talk shows, and one of the things that I happened to appear on a talk show with her in Los Angeles, a local television program. And what was very disturbing to me, and I came back just with this horrible feeling in the pit of my stomach, is that the church, it's like the ERA, anti-ERA campaign, deja vu. The church is now taking the tack that women should discuss women's issues. And so it's sending women, rather than male priesthood authorities, to respond to Deborah Lake on these programs. Well, it was a painful experience for me because the two women, I felt compassion for the two women that had to take me on in a certain way. I didn't really take them on, actually. I tried to be as kind and reasonable as I could and tried to be as articulate as I could on the issues. But they hadn't thought about the issues. I've had 20 years of being a feminist, and I've thought the issues through, and I continue to think them through every day. And I hate the fact that the church is setting up women against women yet again. And I find that very disturbing. And I guess that unnerved me to have that woman leave, I guess. I felt like maybe we hadn't been articulate enough. But I thought that we had tried to, again, to tell you that I thought I was suggestive in my opening comments. We have to take this book seriously. We have to look at it. And it's not just its visibility, as I said in my opening comments. It's the fact that we recognize that these abuses occur, that wrapped in...